You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
This is Lois Richter. Don is making funny faces. It's so good. This is Lois Richter at KDRT. We hope you're having a good day. It is a bright, beautiful, sunny day in Davis. And Don, I am shocked. I went this morning, as we always do, my husband and I go through the weather. Mm-hmm. 79 on Wednesday, mm-hmm. 89 on Thursday, 90 in the next couple of days. And then we're going down to 69?
68 on Monday, according to what I'm looking at, with a slight chance of shower. So we're going to have some weather whiplash here in the Sacramento Valley. It is a bright, beautiful day in Sacramento Valley, Northern California here today. And we've been having splendid weather, except that for the last 3 days, we've been having a north wind here in Davis. If you move to this area from pretty much anywhere else, something you're going to encounter is our north wind episodes, which typically go on 2 to 3 days when they occur. And the middle day, it's pretty miserable, especially when pines, oaks, sycamores.
You got hay fever, don't you, Don?
Perennial ryegrass, olives, privets are all blooming at the same time. You're probably allergic to one of those. If you're not, you may even be allergic to many of them. So hay fever has been a major thing for people for the last couple of days. Good news, the wind has died down. We're going to shift back to southwesterly winds, which come off the ocean and are not as laden with pollen. And as Lois noted, today's high, let's see, we're preparing the show on May 7th, 2025 for broadcast on May 8th, 2025, and today's high will be 77. Tomorrow's high will be 86. Night temperatures are all above 50. 50 tonight, 53 tomorrow night, Thursday night. Warming up Friday to 90 degrees. I think is that the first time we've hit 90 this year? Maybe so. Friday night, 54 degrees. Saturday, 91. Saturday night, 54 degrees. For those of you who hear 90 and think, oh, it's too hot. No, that's what your summer
vegetables. That's normal.
They love it. They love that. That's what your tomatoes and peppers and all those kinds of plants love. But then rapidly dropping down Sunday, 79 degrees and sunny. Sunday night, mostly clear, 51. And as noted, Monday, slight chance of showers, mostly sunny with a high near 68. So 91 on Saturday, 68 on Monday. That will get a little confusing for these subtropical and tropical plants that make up our summer vegetable and flower gardens. But trust me, with the night temperatures where they are, they'll be fine. Oh, wait, Monday night, 48. Tuesday, 71. So what you'll see from this, and we often find ourselves explaining this 3 to 5 days after the fact, plants that are growing vigorously have tender, fleshy new growth. The leaves that are expanding when they're subjected to a 20 to 25 degree temperature fluctuation and wind will sometimes curl and cup along the edges. It's just a distortion caused by damage to the leaf meristem, the tissue where the cells are dividing. Sometimes it gets inhibited, and so instead of expanding nicely and evenly, they buckle. And so my lilacs will do this. Citrus is putting on a lot of tender new growth right now. We'll do it. Your tomato plants will do it. It's just a distortion of the leaf, and it's not really harmful at all, but we are likely to see several samples of this sort of thing over the next few days.
It will be back. That leaf does not uncurl.
Nope,
it doesn't. A new leaf comes out and it's fine.
Usually,
but the leaf that's curled or cupped, it's going to stay that way.
And if you take curled and cupped leaves into a lot of places, garden centers and such, someone there may say to you, oh, you have a virus. You need to be concerned about this. It is possible. It is possible on tomatoes and things that you might indeed have a virus, but you'll know very quickly, because if you have a virus, the next leaves that come out will be buckled and distorted, and the new growth will continue that way. Whereas if it's just a weather thing, transient phenomenon, next leaves are fine. Don't worry about it. So just to let you know, with this kind of fluctuation in the weather, you may see some foliage distortion. The key thing about the weather that you all need to know is that for the last 3 days, in the last 3 days, ET rate has totaled almost a full inch of water. Okay.
That's because of the wind.
Yes, the wind and the temperature, and of course, the day length. We're getting to very, very long days. And so we have used more water in the last 3 days, or plants would, if they have it available to them, use more water in the last 3 days than they did in the previous 7 or 8 days. We just went through a period of much cooler weather, a lot of overcast, not much rain. We actually haven't had measurable rainfall here since the middle of March, but we had cloudy days, drizzle, you know, that kind of a little bit of showers here and there. So the ET rate had been very low. And then all of a sudden it's jumped up. I mean, we've gone from one day a week ago where our ET rate was a tenth of an inch to day before yesterday when it was 0.4 of an inch. So pretty big difference there. And the biggest thing we're seeing on this is that we know the top few inches of soil have dried out and plants are flushing with tender new growth right now. Guy came in with drooping, wilting new growth on his pistachio tree, Chinese pistache. And he was concerned that he might have a disease or something. He said, no, you've just suddenly reached a soil moisture problem. Give it a really good soaking. That's the good news. You didn't have verticillium wilt or anything like that. It's simply that the soil is drying out. So to get to a question I think Lois is about to ask.
Is it time to turn on the sprinklers? Now, last week you said yes. So I assume the answer remains yes, because we haven't had any rain. But is it time to, how do you know how much? Well, actually, we've got a question coming about that. Yeah. Let's finish the opening and then we'll jump into that thing.
So over the last 7 days, our ET rate has approached 2 inches just because we had so much dry wind. We're getting towards summer pattern of water use by plants. Yes, indeed, your sprinklers should be on. And many of our questions at our garden center are related to that. Anyway, that's the weather for the upcoming week. Is going to be warm, 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 and then suddenly cooler and then warming up again. Pretty typical May pattern here in the Sacramento Valley.
And this is our week where we have the spring fundraiser for the station, meaning that every show that you listen to this week, somebody's going to say, listeners, if you like the show, please send us money. Or something equivalent.
Yeah, we're celebrating 20 years of grassroots radio here at KDRT, and that would not be possible without the support of listeners like you. And so for this spring fundraiser, if you enjoy the Davis Garden Show or That's Life or Jazz After Dark or Hawaiian music or
any of them.
There's so many different kinds of music that we have here. I'm probably the most eclectic programming you'll find anywhere. Well, that's what you find on local public radio like KDRT. And this is really simple. Just head on over to kdrt.org/donate. And you know what? You'll find t-shirts and KDRT hats.
We got swag.
And I have this idea that I know we're one of the shows where people are listening all over the world. Well, wouldn't it be really cool to have KDRT hats all over the world? Well, if you want to get one, you want to get one? You could even donate your car if you want to. If you want to get one, you can go to kdrt.org/donate. You'll find ways you can to contribute once or set up a monthly support. There are, yes, there is swag, t-shirts, and hats. Just head on over there and while you're there, look at the schedule guide and look at what you're listening to and what's available to you. As I said, I mentioned Hawaiian music. There's cowboy songs. There's a great country show. There's another jazz show other than mine where Gary Chu comes in and does third stream type of jazz. There are three or four where it's just amazingly eclectic music, and there are some really cool public affairs programs here at KDRT. So take a look around the schedule guide, click on over to the donate guide, and send us some love.
I want to tell you about something that is, I find, extremely exciting. I saw something on PBS on the NewsHour that I had never seen before. And it was this woman playing a mandolin, a just amazing bluegrass mandolin. Mm-hmm. And her name is Sierra Hull.
Mm-hmm.
And she's going to be on KDRT. Oh my gosh, what a coup. But yeah. Rocky Outcrop with the Yolo County Breakdown is going to have her on. It will be May 16th. So put that on your calendar, May 16th. Yeah.
He's been bringing some amazing guests into the studio. And if you happen to be listening to the live version of KDRT at 95.7 FM locally or live streaming at kdrt.org, all the DJs have their fellow DJs coming over. They're doing extended programs. They're doing special shows. I ran a jazz show this week that was just Duke Ellington, all Duke Ellington this week, because I know he's, to me, the greatest jazz artist of the 20th century. Well, there he is. He's you can listen to an entire hour of Duke Ellington on Jazz After Dark. Lois does That's Life, where she interviews fascinating people from around Dave. They're all on there. So just leave it on kdrt.org on the live streaming or 95.7 FM. Listen to what we've got to offer. And then, as I say, head over to kdrt.org/donate.
So Rocky Outcrop is going to be at 10 a.m. on Friday. And on the 16th is that wonderful show. I have an announcement that I am sorry to say, I've been moved again. So my show, That's Life, has been shifted one more time. So I'm now Tuesdays at noon. Okay. Tuesdays at noon. I'll put that on my Facebook so that people hear about it. But
I personally thank Gino and the friends at Yolo Public Library. I have a listener who had jumped in a few weeks back and had been going to those sales and finding Sunset Western Garden books, which is out of print. The last edition was printed a dozen years ago. And I mentioned we really wanted to get a hold of some of these for garden coordinators at schools and teachers. So this friend, this listener, went over there and started looking for them, brought it to the attention of Gino and the others who manage that whole thing. Lois is more familiar with the library sales than I am. And they started setting them aside for him. And they started watching for other good garden books as well. I have now given away, oh my God, at least a dozen, more than that, of the older editions of the Sunset Western Garden book to teachers. One lady came in who knew four or five garden coordinators and asked if she could have another one. And I handed her five of them. They're getting out there. They're getting to the schools. They're getting to garden programs. And this is because people are doing this for us. I haven't gone to these sales and done this. Gino and the other folks there at Yolo Public Library are keeping an eye out for these. And we're getting them out to people who need them. So this has been a great, great boon to local garden coordinators at the schools. And we're watching for books on bonsai and orchids and things like that. And I'm accumulating those as well to develop a kind of a lending library for those purposes as well. So if you're in and you see a pile of books over by my desk, say, are these the ones you're talking about? I will say, yes. Are you interested in bonsai? At your junior high school garden club? Take this, please. And this has been really, really helpful because honestly, I don't know what East Coast people do, but in the West, the Sunset Western Garden Book has been referred for as long as I can remember to as the Bible of gardening in the Western states. Every good gardener out here has one. They may be 40 years old, but they have one. I've run through, looked back at some of the older editions, and probably the only part that isn't really relevant now is when they tried to give people advice on pest control way in the back of the book. Other than that, the climate information, the maps, the information, the encyclopedia itself about all the individual plants remains valid and remains current. Each newer edition expanded that encyclopedia portion. But again, thanks to the folks there for putting this together and helping us keep it going. It's been really helpful. And you should know that there are garden group coordinators now out there benefiting from the work you're doing. So thank you very much.
And if listeners would like to support the Friends of the Yolo Public Library, you can go to their sales, which is the first Friday of, well, on the first Friday of every month, the sale starts and it goes Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So it's a 3-day sale, more information later. But in addition to the library, you know, we have listeners who really take care of us. And one lady came by and to my house, knocked on the door and said, I saw this and I thought of you here. And she gave me a book. The title is The Gardener Says, Quotes, oh Quips, and Words of Wisdom. So thank you, Gaina, for dropping that book by. It's interesting.
You now have quotes for the rest of the year, I would imagine, from there.
One of the people who wrote in, and I'm going to read this one. This is from Anne in Medford, Oregon.
Okay.
Hello, Davis Garden Show. I followed your advice and planted several super xeric trees in my South Oregon Zone 8B garden. We planted this ceanothus, and there's a photo, on the hottest day of the year last summer. Seriously, it was over 100 degrees that day. Yes, we know better, but we were so excited we just couldn't stop. We kept it watered all summer, and when the winter rains set in, we stopped watering. This area used to have oaks that I loved, but were causing damage to our house. It's on a slope with sun almost all day. It is surrounded by 18 plants from a xeric plant combo that I got from High Country Gardens.
Oh, great organ, poppies, great nursery, yeah.
The poppies were seeded last fall to provide soil stabilization, that's during the rains, until we could get it multiplied. Many will be pulled out as soon because they are crowding the nepeta, red valerian, yarrow, and other plants. Yep. And the ceanothus seems healthy and shows no distress. I was wondering how to water it going forward. It has an emitter about 12 inches upslope from the trunk. There are emitters for each of those 18 plants that surround it. And what the other plants are about 5 feet away from this ceanothus. Mm-hmm. What do you recommend for this little treat of a tree? As always, Anne in Medford.
So that depends on your soil. It is important here in the valley and presumably there to continue to water woody California native plants through their first summer in the ground, or second summer, I guess, in the case of this tree. But to back off, I am very pleased to hear that the emitter is about 12 inches upslope from the trunk. We talk a lot on this program about Phytophthora crown rot, Phytophthora cinnamomi, crown and root rot, which is the major threat to our woody native California native plants, as well as plants from Australia and South Africa. They're very vulnerable to this particular pathogen, which attacks when there's moisture right next to the crown under high temperature conditions. The rule I remember, it's not an absolute rule, but the rule I remember is 90 and 90. When the temperature is 90 degrees and the humidity is 90%, Phytophthora is ready to get a foothold. Well, we don't get 90% humidity here, but when we have moisture trickling at the base of a woody plant and the temperature is above 90 degrees, you have that constant moisture. The thing about Phytophthora that's fascinating and also mildly creepy is it has motile spores, which is why it's not considered a fungus or even a plant anymore. It's got its own kingdom over there with the blue-green algae, if I recall. The spores can swim on the film of water on the surface of a piece of sand or compost or in the open pore areas in your soil. And it requires that kind of high moisture status and high temperatures. So if you're trickling water on the plant for a long period of time and it's right next to the base, you're inviting trouble with ceanothus, with fremontodendron, any of the other California natives. And I know we're in Oregon and there's native up there as well, but this is really for our listeners here. This is a big issue with our denser soils. There's a lot going right here. It's on a slope, first of all. So excess water will always drain away from this plant. The emitter is not next to the trunk. It's several inches away. So that's really important. What this plant would need is a deep soaking, probably in our soil, every 7 to 10 days, perhaps as much as 14 days, without that interval between waterings during its now second summer. And then the third summer, you can gradually back off. I'm going to say this, though, here where we get hot and dry all summer and we're growing ceanothus, which are not native here in the valley. They're generally coastal or Southern California natives. They do need irrigation even when they're established, or they benefit from it maybe once a month when they're more established. So one more soaking, every month during the summer, not 2025, I'm talking 2026, will probably be something you'll want to do. This year, I want to have you back off on the frequency, increase the duration, and go by the plant performance. Any more frequently, keeping the soil around it too wet, you're inviting trouble. So you're doing everything right. First of all, everything about this is correct. Slope, drip emitter further away, and irrigating now, if you follow the advice here, less frequently and longer as you go, I think you'll be fine. And I think that you should probably continue to irrigate through this summer and then half as often, maybe longer next summer, and get to the point where you're only maybe watering that whole bed once a month, if your soil allows that. And I'm not familiar with the soils around Medford. I'm not familiar with your soil types there. So it will be important to Maybe do a simple soil test with respect to how it's going to retain moisture. Maybe look on a soil map. Here in California, we have a fantastic online soil map that you can look at. I don't know if there is such a thing up there that you can find locally that'll show your soil types. And if you brought in soil for this raised planter, you should consider the structure of that soil, the drainage of that soil, and maybe adjust my advice a little bit in terms of frequency and duration. But I think if you would to water longer and back off over time, that's going to be your best bet. Generally speaking, here in the Valley, when people plant ceanothus, and this is my frustration as a nursery owner, because they are the most popular California native. They're not native here in our zone. And people plant them, and the dense soils here retain moisture and retain nutrients. The typical pattern is they grow really vigorously. They grow great 2 to 3 years, and then up and die because of Phytophthora crown rot. Challenging for us to manage because, well, it can be irrigation related. It also can be rainfall related for us. I'm sure that's true in Medford as well. We get rain in April some years. We get rain in May some years. So the soil gets saturated at a time when the temperatures are increasing. That's nature taking out the plant, unfortunately. But the more common problem is watering too often, drip system too close to the plant, keeping it damp during a heat wave and inviting Phytophthora cinnamomi. Someone asked me, is it everywhere? Is this a disease that is here but not there? I will never forget my plant pathology professor simply saying, assume it's everywhere. Any place that people have carried dirt on their boots, tractors, animals, Phytophthora cinnamomi is probably present. The next question was, well, is it native here? No, we have no idea actually where it came from originally. I don't think anybody really knows the origin of Phytophthora cinnamomi, but it's not considered to have been native to North America, but it's present here for at least a couple hundred years in agricultural areas where soils are mixed and turned and graded and people stomp around with mud on their boots. It's pretty much everywhere. It's a big problem in revegetation projects where they want to go in and replant natives after something has been done. It's a real common problem in nursery stock. I hate to say that, but it's true. Nurseries are a common source of Phytophthora. So just assume it's there. Manage your soil accordingly, allowing a substantial period of surface drying between waterings, even for plants that do need some summer irrigation. That's the way to minimize the problem. The question, generally, the last question on this is usually, should I mulch around the plant? Standard advice I've given and implemented when we were landscape contractors was you bring in the bark mulch at the end of the planting, and then you spread it all around. And the last step is you go and you pull it away from the woody stem of vulnerable plants or any plants, lavender, rosemary, native shrubs, and so forth. So one of the last things you do is you just take a rake and gently rake it away from the stem of the plant. Conversations online with my favorite professor, Dr. Linda Chalker Scott up in Washington State. She suggests that what she calls geometric mulches, my favorite term, chunky things that have big air spaces, that's probably not an issue. It's dirt up against the crown that's a concern. But we always felt that just to be on the safe side, because these plants are so vulnerable to Phytophthora, you mulch everything and then you gently rake it away. So there's just nothing piled up around the base of the plant, nothing crowding and trapping moisture against the wood or bark of these vulnerable plants. So I think that's a reasonable precaution, even though she tends to feel that chunkier mulches, it's not a concern. It's just you don't want moisture trapped around a woody stem in high temperatures, particularly for plants from Californian, woody California natives, Mediterranean plants, South African, Australian plants that could be vulnerable to Phytophthora.
Okay, that was a lot of really good information, Don. I want to back up a little bit, and looking at her picture, It is definitely on a slope. You can see the slope on there, and you can see where the ceanothus is, and before the ceanothus, there's a blank spot. So I'm thinking, if you want to know how your soil works, you could take and put water equivalent to where it is in the ceanothus, but just above the blank spot. Let it run the same amount of time. And then when you're done, go and dig around in there and find out where the water went. Did it go straight down? Yep. Did it run out? Is it flowing over the top? You know, what's happening to that water? And that way you would know how your soil handles the water, just as knowledge for you to have for the future. My second question, though, to Don is, the ceanothus, should it have a basin around it or should it not? Now, it's on a slight slope, I guess. Well, actually, a pretty good slope. Should it have a basin around it?
I think in this instance, it doesn't need to. I'm looking at the picture. It's performing well. Hey, here's a really important Davis Garden Show aphorism. Plant performance is your best indicator of whether your irrigation system is working correctly. And it's working fine. From everything I can see, I don't see a problem. So
what that means is when I go out my back door, like I did 3 weeks ago, and I see the rose bush that had been flushing out, is all of the leaves are brown and crunchy. I know there's a problem. Yes. Well, the sprinkler had, the little drip had gotten disconnected. It gotten pulled out. It wasn't getting any water at all.
Well, here's a slight digression. Yes, that plant performance is your best indicator there. Although one thing to know, we're just about at that season with our roses. If one shoot has collapsed from wilt and the rest of the plant has not,
oh, that's thrips.
That's raspberry horntail borer, which is a particular borer that gets in. I've only seen the wasp itself once. It lands, it oviposits, its little larva gets in there and starts tunneling around. And once it makes a complete circuit of the tender shoot, the thing above that, the whole plant above that point collapses. It looks like a shepherd's hook at that point. And the key is the rest of the plant is not doing that. So I've had people take pictures of raspberry horntail borer and say, do I have a watering problem? No, you have an insect problem. And you just prune it out and don't worry about it. Just move, you know, they're not going to be a huge issue. But that is one thing to know, is that you need to look a little closer. Wilt isn't always because of drought. Sometimes it's because of a pest problem. So,
but this when looks all great, the leaves on the rose are brown and crunchy,
if all of them are, either there's something wrong with your irrigation or you have a gopher, because gophers love roses. I can tell
you. But they don't get in my pots, though. That's the cool thing.
Thank goodness. Yes. If they figure that out, I'm sunk.
Okay. Well, I think
great picture. Thank you very much for this. And it's a great combination of plants. One thing I will say about ceanothus is that whenever someone buys a ceanothus, I want to say, how about if you buy a Toyon while you're at it?
Because the Toyon will live longer than the ceanothus. It's slow to grow. And by the time the ceanothus croaks, you've got a Toyon.
Yeah, Toyon grows typically, mine have grown about 2 to 3 feet a year, which is pretty good. They're pretty upright at first, and then they make a great big shrub. And I did see an article at one point, an actual, you know, scientific type article. Toyon and Baccharis, the coyote bush, appear to be resistant to Phytophthora. Hmm. And so I had a customer who wanted to do a Fremontodendron hedge. Now, there's a lot of reasons I would never do that personally, but they were dead set on it. So, okay, fine. You know, go order your Fremontodendron from someone else. I don't even want them going through my nursery. Two of my staff have gone to urgent care because of the trichomes on Fremontodendron. I'm not going to stock those, but they wanted them. Fine. Leave gaps in your hedge. And in those gaps, plant coyote bush and Toyon, because when, not if, but when the Fremontodendrons die, the Toyon, because they're very vulnerable to Phytophthora, the Toyon will be there and you'll still have your hedge. And coyote bush is a very vigorous plant that has a fragrant flower, hugely attractive to beneficial insects and various other organisms. Very vigorous, takes well to pruning, but not the most exciting or attractive thing. Nice background plant. And then Toyon is spectacular. The blooms attract pollinators. The berries are popular with certain types of birds and very attractive here in the wintertime. And they'll get pretty much as big as you let them. If you're in Davis, there's a Toyon on the corner of 8th and L that's probably 15 feet tall. I have some hitting 12 feet here on my property after only 8 or 10 years. So they've gotten pretty big pretty quickly. And it appears to be quite tolerant of garden watering. So among our native woody plants for the valley, even though they're not technically native here on the valley floor, it's one of the best choices. And coyote bush is practically indestructible. Coyote bush Baccharis is usually available only in the ground cover form at most garden centers, Pigeon Point or Twin Peaks being very good choices in that regard. But if you have room for the big ones, they are pretty impressive background plants. And most people don't mention the fragrance. Baccharis pilularis is dioecious. You have male and female plants. The male flowers have a quite spicy, sweet fragrance. And it's in the evening. It's one of those plants where it's getting towards dusk and you suddenly get this strong, sweet scent. And it lasts for a couple of hours. And it's a nice fragrance. It's not overbearing. And then again, we had one that kind of fell apart. And my kid was saying, what do we do about this? I said, cut it to the ground. It's a fire plant. It's a plant that comes right back from burning to the ground. So cut it to the ground and it'll come right back. So it's a plant that you can manage that way. Toyon is a much more elegant thing. But, you know, if you want to make sure that you still have a hedge, if the ceanothus happens to curl up its toes and die, Toyon and Baccharis are good things to add to the combination. That was a great segue. And
if you want, wait, one more. If you want to get that bigger Baccharis, go to the Arboretum plant sale.
Except they're all done for the year.
I know, but come on. People are going to plan years in advance, aren't they?
Hey, Annie planted in the middle of July and did well at it. So it is possible to plant things year round. And I also plant right on through the summer. Actually, what I would say about that, a brief segue, you will get your best selection of California native plants at nurseries that specialize in them. I'm a garden retailer, so I'm undercutting myself here as I say this, but most of us who have broad interest garden centers will have a display of California native plants. Of course, there's an interest in them. We have a great deal of difficulty finding reliable suppliers who can produce retail quality California native plants in enough quantity and over enough of a season to maintain that good display year round. But in the area, in Sacramento, there's two or three I can think of. Over in Sonoma County, there's a really good native plant nursery. In Elk Grove, there's a very good one. Go to them if you're doing a landscape predominantly comprised of California native plants, because you're going to find the selection you need there. They may not be retail quality. They won't be nice, compact plants. They might not be in bloom or whatever it is that we as garden retailers want to have, but they will be nice, healthy plants, and they'll be well-rooted. And you're just going to get frustrated if you try to fill up your yard with California natives from your average garden center. We'll have stuff. Sure, check out the display at normal garden centers. But if you're doing a whole landscape of predominantly woody California native plants, go to the native plants like CalFlora Nursery over in Sonoma County, California Flora Nursery. And most of them post some kind of an inventory online. They tend to be small operations, specialists. They know how to grow these rather challenging, fussy plants from a retail nursery standpoint. They know how to grow them as a healthy plant that will transplant out well. So if you're looking around, that's the way to get your Baccharis pilularis that doesn't happen to be the dwarf one. That was a long segue, and I'm going to leap right over into another one here. A couple of weeks ago, we were talking about vines, and we were talking about native vines, the California native vines for our zip code, which is 95616. We just didn't find a whole lot to work with, but I do want to mention one that I think is actually a great California native vine, Lunicera. Okay, that's the genus of honeysuckles. Hispidula. Hispidula. No, I'm not recommending Onicera japonica. I actually think, you know, I'm not big on banning plants, but if there were one to ban, it would be Japanese honeysuckle. It just takes over everything. But our California native Onicera, Onicera hispidula, is a nice, well-mannered, fragrant, pink-flowered honeysuckle. Who doesn't like honeysuckle, at least in concept? The fragrance in the evening is wonderful. There's various moths and things that visit the flowers. They're twining vines that will quickly, sometimes rampantly, cover a structure or a trellis, but this one is not overwhelming. So it's hard to find. I can say this one. So it's a good tie into the comment about going to California native specialty nurseries. Lonicera hispidula. Let me find a common name for you so you know what you're looking for. Sometimes called California honeysuckle. Oh, there we go. More commonly known, says Wikipedia, as pink honeysuckle. It's got pink flowers and it grows to, you know, 10 to 20 feet and it twines on things. So give it some kind of a support, but it is not the kind of honeysuckle that overwhelms your yard. It's not a nuisance plant at all. And it's a nice vine. It's a California native, not here on the valley floor. There's a lot of California natives that are what I call the bathtub ring plants. We're in the bottom of the bathtub. These grow in the ring around the bathtub. slightly upslope from where we are. They tend to have less dense soils, but this is, I believe, more of a riparian type species. So it can take garden watering, I know, and it can probably take some drought as well. And generally speaking, honeysuckles are reasonably shade tolerant as well as tolerant of full sun. So if you're still listening and looking for a California native vine that does well here, Lonicera hispidula, the California or pink honeysuckle. Don't buy the other one at the nursery. Don't buy the Japanese honeysuckle. Yeah. I've made the mistake of planting them. I've also seen yards completely overtaken by them. There's a park in North Davis where it is engulfing all the shrubs and trees, and the city staff can't keep after it. It's such an overwhelming vine. I don't know who planted it there, but maybe even the birds, who knows. But Lonicera japonica, the Japanese honeysuckle, is a major nuisance, invasive practically everywhere it's grown. California honeysuckle is a great alternative.
John, when we were talking about plants after the show was over, I was thinking, you know, there's that wild cucumber thing.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And that's a vine. Now it's not very exciting.
Oh, it's exciting. I think it's very exciting because it grows incredibly fast for a very short period of time. Man root.
But the roots stay.
Man root is the common name for it because the root structure tuber, I guess, gets big enough that they're huge. Even in coastal San Diego, where we average 9 inches of rainfall a year entirely between November and February, this plant, this cucumber relative, we just called it wild cucumber, grows. Our neighborhood actually owns a canyon there right near UC San Diego. And on the slopes of the canyon, this thing would come up. My friends and I spent considerable time hiking around, climbing around in that canyon. It would start raining, up would come this wild cucumber. Within a week, it had grown several feet. Within just a couple of weeks, it was all the way up on top of whatever shrub it had come up underneath, and it would grow to 20 feet with no problem, and it would flower and form these bristly, spiny, spiky fruit, which are insanely bitter. If you think you've ever had a bitter cucumber, these have that same compound in them to the nth degree. And then as soon as the rain stopped, February, whole plant would yellow. Die, fruit would drop to the ground, there would be the seed for next year, and that big root would be down there ready to go. So not knowing any better and being curious teenagers, we decided to dig one up and try and transplant it. We dug down and down, and then we hit this thing. And what we dug up was the size of a basketball. And that was a fairly small root structure for this wild cucumber. So this is going to be a tough one for you to find in a garden center, I guarantee. But if you've got the place, for our native manroot, it is a fascinating plant, but again, fairly short growth season because it's entirely tied to the rainfall cycle of your region. However, I wouldn't completely take it out of consideration if you have the right place for it.
Okay, so let's talk about, you know, I come up with these strange thoughts sometimes. So this one I want to talk about: apical dominance, wound healing, and getting a bud to grow.
Okay.
And I'm spraying
these in a sentence.
He has no idea what I'm talking about here. So what I'm thinking is, all right, let's assume I have a twig, a little branch or something, and that particular plant is apically dominant. So the bud at the top is suppressing the growth of the buds down below it. Now this is normal. We've talked about this before. Here's my thought. I know that if I make a cut in a plant, like when you prune a branch off the side of a tree or something, it scars over. It regrows, and eventually the two growing parts stick to each other and they heal. Okay. So I'm thinking, if I've got one of these little branches and I were to take a razor blade and make a very slight cut across part of that twig, just above where there's a bud, I can see the bud, and I cut a little bit above it on that side, not on the other side, but on that side. And then shouldn't that stop the fluid, the apically dominant fluid, from hitting that bud? And would then the bud sprout?
You have just described exactly how they did the first experiments by identifying the source of auxins, which are the hormones that suppress the growth of buds below. So you take your razor blade and you make an excision in the cambium above a bud that you wish to have sprout. You will block the flow of auxins. Now, of course, if you go all the way around, everything above that point will die. But at least temporarily, until it reheals, you have interrupted the flow of auxin, A-U-X-I-N, which are the first identified plant hormones, which are the ones that suppress. Auxins go down, cytokinins go up. So that's an important thing to know in terms of what regulates plant growth. But in terms of blocking the growth of that bud, you have described a practice that is sometimes actually implemented, where you very carefully, you got to know what you're doing, inhibit just above the growth bud, which is the axle of a leaf, and you temporarily block the flow. You might, in some species, perhaps many, cause that bud to grow. Yes. And then of course it'll reheal, you know, from the excision you have made, incision you have made will heal. But by then the growth bud is already underway.
How big, how tall, how far away from that twig does that bud have to have grown in order to not be inhibited once the wound heals? It's like an inch?
Oh, once it's already growing, the control from the top has been obliterated.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So instead
you gotta
of
be careful because blocking, you know, cutting into plants is
I know.
Okay.
I've got a house plant and the top part is too big, yep. But we talked about air layering, yeah, and all sure. that stuff. You know, this seems like it would be really easy. And if it doesn't work,
are we talking about your fiddle leaf fig here?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is a good example. Yeah. One of the problems with fiddle leaf fig, Ficus lyrata, which was hugely popular 3 or 4 years ago, we as retailers, it drove us crazy because they're a frustrating plant in many ways. They typically, it's a tree. If you grow it out where it's native and where, or in Southern California where it can grow outside, we're talking about a 40 by 40 foot tree and you're trying to grow it as a house plant. You typically just grow taller and taller and taller. You might branch from the base, but we'd get questions like, it's 8 feet tall. Now what do I do? I felt like saying, well, throw it out and go buy another one. But what you're describing is a possible way to try and get some lower branching on it. Take a razor blade very carefully where a leaf is or was attached. Either a leaf is there or there's a leaf scar there. At the base of that, you know, right above the point of attachment is a potential bud. It could grow. Yeah. That's sure. Give this a try. And we'll get a report from you in about 3 to 6 months about how well it went. It should sprout pretty much right away if it's going to. And then once it's beginning to grow, maybe then you can cut back the top and you'll have a plant that you're okay with. It's the cutting it back and just waiting. Most people aren't willing to do that. So I think you're onto something here, Lois. Resprouting your Ficus lyrata and then cutting it back and you'll still have an attractive houseplant.
So I do have an announcement for the listeners. If you are in Davis and you want a fiddle leaf fig, I have 3 of them that I am getting rid of. 2 are 6 feet tall. 1 is 5 foot tall. I'm keeping the 3 foot tall one myself. But so, hey, if you want it, give me a call.
How about you email davisgardenshow@gmail.com and Lois will see your request and you'll have yourself a fiddle leaf fig. We've stopped selling those, by the way, happily, because they were...
I tried to give it to Don. He said no.
There are so many houseplants that are easy to grow that when something becomes very trendy that is not easy to grow, I just don't jump on that. And when we keep getting the feedback of this didn't do well, it's dropping all its leaves, you know, you know what, buy a philodendron. They're much easier.
The same thing with the philodendron, because I know it gets no leaves at the beginning of
it's such a variable group that would be a challenging answer. Hypothetically, okay. You could, yes. Now, one of the things you can do with a philodendron or a split leaf philodendron, I did this years ago. They put out aerial roots. You've seen them. Yeah. They bother many people, so they cut them off. Fine, you can cut them off if you want.
Put them back in the pot.
If you find them unattractive, the plant doesn't absolutely need them. But I had one years ago in a room that it put out an aerial root right near my desk. So I took a pickle jar and I filled it with water and I put it and I let the aerial root grow into the pickle jar of water. And then I would put a little, remember Schultz's plant food, yep. The one that was 7 yep. drops per quart. So I would put water in there with 5, 6, 7 drops of Schultz's. All the leaves above that point where that root came from doubled in size as they grew out. And all the leaves below were just living on the nutrient status of what was in the potting soil.
Well, you didn't put the Schultz's in the water that you fed the potting?
No, this is my experiment. We're supposed to see if there was any connection, if there's like a direct connection between that root. There was. Yeah, it worked very well. So if those aerial roots come out and you want to have fun, put a pickle jar right below them, let them grow into it, and occasionally put some fertilizer in there. That was a wild digression. What's your next question?
Well, you can take that stem, because they're bendable, and pull it around and put a pin and hold that into the dirt, and it'll re-root. Then you can cut it off, and you've got another plant.
You can do that. You can just cut it off if they bother you. They're aerial roots. They continue to produce them even with very low humidity. It's surprising that they can actually grow and continue elongating in an environment that I consider, you know, very much less typical than where they would be in nature, but it works. So if you happen to have one, put in a pickle jar. Today's tip, also, I'm going to bring this one to you. Don't forget to water your houseplants right now just because you're out gardening in your vegetable garden, your flower garden. This message brought to you by a guy who forgot to water his houseplants.
Oh, no, Doc. Yeah. Come on, you've got an iPhone. Put it on your calendar. Remind yourself.
I got them.
I switched mine from being every 10 days, which it is in the winter, back to once a week, which is it is in the summer, because, you know, house plants.
In general, when people ask us how often to water their house plants, we generally water our house plants at our nursery once a week. Very thoroughly, we go around and check everything once a week. Over the last week, with the dry wind and humidity, they went 4 days between watering before the first of them began to show signs of needing water. So you do need to keep an eye on them. We're all out planting tomatoes and squash and things like that. Those poor little aglaonemas and things sitting in your living room really do need your attention. It'd be a good time to transplant them. That would just make your life a little bit easier. So
let's go back to the mailbag. And Dave writes to us saying, I love the show. I've been listening for years. What a wonderful source of informative gardening information. You know, I'm going to take a little aside here. And any of you listeners who feel like Dave, send us some money.
Not us. Send KDRT some money.
Oh, that too.
Kdrt.org/donate. Great.
Yeah. I am writing about the lemon tree in the attached image. Yep. Not so worried about the yellowing leaves, as I think it's a symptom of a bigger problem. This tree has been in the same pot for at least 20 years. Ooh.
That's good. Yeah.
The tree is in zone 9B, Antioch, California. Very little frost in my location. Yeah. I've added compost to the surface, earthworm castings, mulch, and generally fertilize the tree with a weak liquid fish emulsion fertilizer.
Okay, hold on. That sentence right there, this is a great way to manage woody plants in containers. We'll get to your question in a minute, but I just want to highlight what you're doing there, because I've done this myself with container plants. You just take some kind of enriched soil product, whether it's a potting soil or earthworm castings, or about 3% nitrogen typically, and you're putting them on the surface and they're breaking down and releasing nitrogen steadily to the plant. Also, the organic part, just like when you do this in your garden, is filtering into the soil somewhat and enriching the soil that way and helping to retain moisture. And then feeding lightly with fish emulsion helps to bump that up a little bit. So this is really excellent container management. I just wanted to highlight that. Okay, go ahead, Lois.
The water is from inline emitters, about a gallon every other day through the summer. Yep. And they have a similar to ours, don't they?
Yeah, it's a little more coastal, obviously, but it gets hot in Antioch.
It's hot, yeah. But it seems like it needs to come out of the pot and get some soil renewal, maybe a makeover, if you will. There you go. So the plan is to tip it over and gently, or as much as possible, pull it out of the pot. Well, then what? Do I trim the roots? Just cut any circling roots? I'm mainly wondering about what soil to put back in. The potting soil best I can find, or a mixture of potting soil, perlite, peat moss, vermiculite, some clay, maybe actual dirt?
Hey, there we go.
In general, what does very long-term garden container gardening look like?
Large container gardening. Well, it looks like what you're doing. And 20 years of a Meyer lemon in the same, I assume it's a Meyer lemon in the same container, is phenomenal. And what you're doing is you're giving it the water it needs and the nutrients it needs. You can grow any plant in any soil for any duration as long as you give it the moisture and the nutrients. And what makes it difficult for those of us in the hot, dry climate is that a plant will get root bound to the point that you're having to, in order to provide those things, the water is literally every day here in the valley. I own a nursery. We water some plants every single day, some plants a couple times a day if they're in small pots. And we have, because of that, and because it, you know, soils don't retain nutrients forever, we have to supplement the nutrients. When I worked in the Botanical Conservatory way back, we were watering with a fertilizer solution every time we watered, a very weak light fertilizer solution. There were plants that were in pots in that greenhouse that are probably still there that we couldn't transplant because they were as big as we could let them get. And they'd been in the same pot for 40 years when I was working there. So as long as we kept providing them the water and the nutrients they needed, they'd keep going. So you're doing everything right here. But to answer your question, what you're essentially proposing is a modification of a bonsai, which is fine. And when you're growing a plant in a container, you're essentially stunting it. It will, no question, but you're still getting the flowers, you're still getting the fruit, the color of the plant, the leaf looks good and so on. So you're giving it what it needs. You're giving it the basics that it needs. When you do a bonsai, you take it out of the pot once a year and you trim off, let's say 20 to 30% of the roots. Circling roots, for sure. roots that are bent or kinked for sure. But generally, you're just taking off any, as I say, 20 to 30% of the root system, and you're putting it right back into the same size container with fresh soil. And that's what you're proposing here. And I do think that would be a good plan. After 20 years in the same container, it probably would benefit from that. You are intentionally stunting the plant when you're growing bonsai, and you're basically doing the same thing here. So yes, trim the roots, just the circling roots. No, take off about a quarter of the root system entirely if you need to. And then it goes right back in. I highly recommend, as with bonsai, that you do this when the weather is mild. Right now, this week, after we get through 90 degree day, going back into the 80s and 70s, great time to do it. So the plant isn't double shocked by roots coming off with hot, dry, windy weather. Here in the valley, 3 days ago would have been a really bad time to do it. Today or tomorrow would be fine. I like to do a lot of transplanting in March and April because the weather is generally mild. But you're on the right track here. As for what soil to put it back in, woody plants that I'm growing in containers, I grow in soils that are predominantly mineral. Okay, shrubs, trees, things like that. And I have lots of them, whether they're in a half barrel or something, I put them into what we sell at our nursery as citrus and palm mix. Happens in almost every garden center has a potting soil labeled for citrus trees. It's generally much more mineral. It's more like the cactus and succulent mix that we sell, rather than the kind of thing we sell for flowers and tomatoes, which is very heavy on organic material. If you fill a half barrel with our citrus and palm mix, and a half barrel next to it with our recipe 420, which is for tomatoes and other things like that, flowers, cannabis, all that kind of thing. By the end of the summer, the 420 barrel will have dropped as much as 4 inches. That's from the organic part breaking down. The citrus and palm mix, or the cactus and succulent mix, will have dropped maybe half an inch to an inch because it's primarily sand, pumice, things like that. Yes, there's peat moss in there. Yes, there's compost in there, but a lot more mineral. Minerals don't break down. So what kind of soil? The answer would be a very good potting soil you find that's basically labeled for that kind of thing. A citrus mix would be great. A cactus mix would be great. Usually, if you use those, you wouldn't need the perlite or the vermiculite or the other things you're asking about because they already have those in them. Very commonly, they have volcanic rock or pumice in them. So if you can buy something appropriate, fine. But if you can't, if your local garden center just predominantly has what I'll call generic potting soils, adding perlite or volcanic rock, pumice is one of our favorites for this purpose, makes a big difference. Those will still be there 5 years, 10 years down the road. The compost will be gone. Earthworm castings are very helpful in terms of retaining moisture. Vermiculite, I don't think I'd bother with that. And I have used actual dirt, as he asked, some actual soil. When I was doing a planter way back when that was going to have my mailbox in it, and it was going to be way down at the end of the driveway, so it was really a hassle to get a hose to it, and I was only going to water every couple of weeks, I added about one part of our native silty loam to about four parts of the potting soil. The issue I did have, some weeds came up that were in the native soil. You need to pull those out right away. But adding native soil to a long-term planting mix isn't a bad thing to do because it does stay there. It helps with the cation exchange capacity, the nutrient retention, the moisture retention. So some native soil is actually fine as long as you blend it in, as long as your soil is reasonable quality, and just be aware that you're introducing some weed seeds. So keep an eye out for that. So I've done that. But if you can find something that's designed for it, it'll just make your life easier. And most nurseries do sell something specifically because citrus are so popular in containers, specifically labeled for citrus. And then overall, you're doing everything right. What I do with larger containers where I have woody plants that are going to stay in them for a while is about once a year, right about now, I'll take our more enriched potting soil or something like that, and I'll put a half inch to an inch on the surface and I'll pull it away from the stem a little bit. But basically, I'm just top dressing with a potting soil that has nutrients in it. Of course, you could just add some fertilizer, things like that. But what I've found is that when I do this, it shades the roots a bit. It feeds the plant. It just provides a little extra nutrient and moisture retention. And that's our biggest issue in California, you know, the arid parts of California, with managing containers.
So I'm looking at this picture. Thank you. By the way, it's a beautiful picture. And it is, the plant is outside. Mm-hmm. It is in a pot that looks to be about a 5 gallon pot, or a little bigger than that, yeah. But it's smaller than a half barrel.
Yeah.
And it is a terracotta pot. It's sitting in a terracotta water catcher
Yeah.
underneath it. So it, the roots from the plant, which would normally go down that hole and into the ground,
Yes.
can't get to the ground, which means this remains movable at all stages of life. That's one of the unusual things, because normally I would think, well, it doesn't, you know, it's sitting on dirt, they're sitting on mulch, it doesn't need to, well, yeah, having that little basin there is a, it's a good thing.
Yes, if it were sitting on the soil, it would have long ago rooted into the soil yeah. below. I do this all the time. And in which case, simply the whole process of, you know, removing it from where it is will prune off a significant chunk of the root system, possibly a rather important chunk of the root system. So the fact that it's sitting in a tray has saved you some trouble. Now, this lemon, like many Meyer lemons, shows some micronutrient deficiencies. It's so common in the Davis area because of our hard water. We have pH of our water is high that we'll see. But this appears to have iron deficiency. It's fine. You know, these micronutrient deficiencies tend to freak people out. Any of the fertilizers you get for citrus, typically, if they're the conventional, not organic sources, but the conventional sources, they'll add extra iron, magnesium to try and correct these things. Meyer lemon is like so prone to micronutrient deficiencies that people get very concerned about it. But you know what? Look, it's flowering in this picture. It's fruiting, I gather. It's done very well all this time. These micronutrient deficiencies really aren't that big a deal. They, you can try and correct them, but I wouldn't worry that much about it. Yeah, the yellowing is pretty normal. Meyer lemons, bear slimes, grapefruits in particular, generally more yellow in appearance than mandarins and oranges and other types of citrus. Common for them to show micronutrient deficiencies. A zillion products out there that you can use to correct that, or just don't worry about them. That's one of our mottos here. Don't worry about it. It's growing fine. You're doing well. 20 years in the pot is very good. I think it is time to go ahead and repot it. If you could go to a bigger container, okay, great. But if you're not going to do that, I think you're on the right track with the root pruning into a citrus mix and then top dress with something that has some nutrients in it.
All right. Now, we're usually doing garden quotes, and this one is from Alfred Austin. Have no idea who the person is. I just found this. It says, "This is the glory of gardening. Hands in the dirt, head in the sun, and heart with nature."
There you go. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT-LP 95.7 in Davis, California.
Hi folks, Lois Richter and I produce the Davis Garden Show for you every week. Lois has a public affairs show called That's Life, and I play music for you here on Jazz After Dark. That is just three of the 34 locally produced programs here at KDIRT. World music, local artists, country, doo-wop, jug band, Grateful Dead, gospel, folk, Hawaiian, classical, in-studio musicians, and a whole range of eclectic programming every week. Not to mention great local news and public affairs programs and much more. That's what you get with public radio. So if you like what you hear, please head on over to kdrt.org/donate, kdrt.org/donate. It's our spring fundraiser this week, so it's a great time to help out at whatever level you are comfortable with. Check out the t-shirts and hats and maybe consider setting up a monthly donation. Here at KDIRT, we thank you for your support past and future. And as always, thanks for listening.